It's rather sad that Alan is unwell, and Karen, his wife, some of you will remember, he was due to give a paper at the Dr. Williams Library on 1662, and Karen did a good job of reading his paper. I only hope I do the paper justice. This is a paper which Alan has entitled The Unsung Ministers of Congregationalism, List B. I was wondering what the connection between List B is and Sylvester Hall. I could only come up with an incredibly tenuous one. I just checked with Clyde before. I understand that Sylvester Hall died on the deck of a boat when he was on holiday going from Toronto. And I know of one List B minister who also died on his way home from holiday. Fine List B minister. Anne doesn't mention him, but and that is a man called Albert Locke. And Albert Locke, of course, was a LMS CWM missionary. He was List B. He came from a very humble background. He was a postman and went into ministry. No formal college training at all. Went to Botswana. I think the expression these days is when you don't know how to do something, you wing it. And Albert was a brilliant winger in Botswana. He couldn't speak the language, or he understood a little bit of it, but his pronunciation was perfect, and he got away with it. He had the prayer book with him when he went around in Botswana taking services. It was over a reading. All people thought that he knew the language wonderfully well. His skill was in being a church diplomat, really, and he was instrumental in helping the United Congregational Church of Southern Africa to come into being, and it was his very painstaking work that enabled that to happen. And when Alfred Merriweather, who wasn't one of our ministers, he was a United Free Church of Scotland minister, and was Speaker of the Botswana Parliament, when he stood down, Albert was elected to be Speaker of the Botswana Parliament, and he did an amazing job, and he came back to England eventually when he retired, ended up in Billingshurst in West Sussex, and sadly died on an aeroplane when he was coming back from holiday in Greece. But a great man, and there were many great List B ministers, as Alan says. And so that is Alan's paper. Information on the dissenting academies to which Baptists, Congregationalists, Presbyterians and Unitarians sent their young men, and on the theological colleges of England and Welsh Congregationalism isn't difficult to find. But historically, and to this day, many ministers have arrived at their pastorates by a non-collegiate route, and their tale has thus far not been adequately told. From the earliest days, Congregationalists would seek out gifted brethren from among their members and through their church meetings and call them to ministry. Those called in some cases served their home churches, in other cases they were released to serve needy causes elsewhere or to plant new ones. Many were regarded as lay pastors, and many of them exercised a tent-making ministry. Under the impetus of the evangelical revival of the 18th century, home no less than foreign mission clamoured for attention. Thus, for example, in 1797, just 2 years after the foundation of the London Missionary Society, the Surrey Mission was formed with the objective of reaching villages that were otherwise deprived of the gospel. By 1836, There were 579 mission stations in 39 county associations. In 1839, at the first assembly of the Congregational Union of England and Wales, a plan for the evangelisation of the entire country was presented. A distinction was drawn between lay agents who would work under the supervision of churches and pastors, and ministerial missionaries who would be college trained. By the following year, the Home Missionary Society had 120 missionaries on its roll, and this despite the fact that some college students declined such pioneering work on the ground that traditional pastorates were more respectable and comfortable. Nobody denied that congregational churches were competent to call whomsoever they willed to serve them as pastors. But since on some occasions calls were addressed to ignorant or otherwise unacceptable men, the question of their financial support was raised as early as 1845. Many felt that the Union was under no obligation to fund those in whom it had no confidence. And by the end of the 19th century, matters began to come to a head. In 1901, D.W. Simon declared that of 3,123 congregational ministers, 692 had received no college education, and many deemed it a matter of urgency to address this situation. A start was made by adding a section B to the list of ministers printed in the Congregational Yearbook. Thus, in the 1901 volume, we find a six-page list of evangelists and lay pastors holding regular appointments with or without stipend in connection with county unions or churches officially furnished for the year commencing January the 1st, 1901. Steps were shortly taken towards the organisation of non-collegiate ministerial education. On the 1st of March, 1904, a special subcommittee on county union examinations, appointed by the General Committee of the Congregational Union, met for the first time. A three-year course, including required reading, was devised for those seeking admission to List A. The Bible, theology, and church history were to be studied over the 3 years, with English history in the first, English literature in the second, and logic and philosophy in the third. It was also agreed, as indicating the comparative importance of these departments, that 35% of the marks be allocated to work in the Bible, 30% to theology, 20% to church history, and 15% to work in each other subject. The subcommittee further recommended that the general committee appoint an examination board who shall select examiners, determine dates and places of examiners, receive examiners' reports, and report decisions to the general committee. Finally, it was recommended that the board comprise 7 members, including J.D. Jones of the Union and W.B. Selby. Among those who passed the List A examinations were some who became well known in the denomination. Among them, Dr. James Alfred Kay, initially trained at the Independent Harley College, who exercised an outstanding ministry as Bishop of the Guildford Church and its nine village causes. Martin Shepherd, who came into the ministry via the China Inland Mission, returning later to that country under the auspices of the London Mission Society and ending as moderator of the North Eastern Province. We have Martin's daughter Helen here this morning. Robert Deuce, of religious drama and pioneer television epilogues fame, and John Ridden, whose pastoral and administrative experience admirably equipped him to become the first General Secretary of the Council for Churches in Britain and Ireland. To this day, the United Reformed Church Ministry benefits from the service of a number of children of ministers who came to List A via List B, among them Anthony Burnham, Alan Galt, and Helen's brother Noel Shepherd. It should be carefully noted that for the rest of this paper, and with one concluding exception, I have in mind those only who remained on List B throughout their ministries. So we move to the training of List B evangelists. From time to time, the question of non-conservative pastors was raised, but it was the Yorkshire County Union which brought matters to a head in 1911. It sent a successful motion to the Congregational Council from 1905, formerly the General Committee. I quote, "It was resolved to ask the Council of the Congregational Union of England and Wales to take immediate steps to formulate regulations for the admission and status of evangelists through the country." And in response, the Council convened a conference re-status of evangelists on the 30th of November 1911. We learn that after a long discussion, it was resolved to appoint a subcommittee to draft regulations for the admission of names upon List B and upon such lines as may now be determined. It was agreed that candidates for admission to the list should have served a probationary period and passed a preliminary examination, and that they should be members of a congregational church. The drafting committee comprised J. E. Flower, M.A., J. E. Jones, M.A., B.D., E. Johnston Saxton, and Messrs. W. H. Brown, Montague Holmes, and A. E. Huntley, M.A. On the 15th of February 1912, the subcommittee re-rules and regulations as to the recognition of evangelists and lay pastors endorsed the findings of the conference and instructed county union secretaries to return only the names of men who are members of congregational churches and holding the office of evangelist or lay pastor as now defined. It was further decided that those who successfully completed a further 3 years of examined study would be admitted to List A. By contrast with those on List A, List B ministers were not ordained, but were normally recognised or inducted, and their stipends were lower. The first List B examinations, recorded under the heading Evangelists Examination, were held in 1917. At their meeting of the 17th of December 1917, the list B examiners heard that of the 9 candidates, 6 had failed. They also noted the criticism that the present system tends both to let in and keep out the wrong men. It was resolved that the Settlements and Removals Committee should obtain a satisfactory report from county unions of the work done throughout the year by the men seeking admission, giving special heed to character, industry, preaching and pastoral qualifications, and power of appeal to young people. Secondly, the candidate shall undertake a course of reading under the guidance of a fully accredited minister who shall report to the examiners. And thirdly, where necessary, a viva voce examination shall be arranged. The List B examination syllabus was revised from time to time, and for example in 1917 it covered New Testament, Old Testament, Congregationalism, English grammar and composition, and a sermon. It's worthy of note that examiners of a high caliber were engaged, A.J. Grieve and Robert Franks among them. Perhaps not surprisingly, success in the examinations was not a foregone conclusion. We find, for example, that in 1919, 11 candidates were entered for the examinations, of whom 3 passed and 8 failed, and 2 were allowed to pass. Following consultation with county unions, 7 of the 8 who failed were recalled for oral examinations, of whom 2 were successful. In 1923, no fewer than 25 men sat the examinations, of whom 7 passed, and 9 were successful in subsequent oral examinations. A significant change occurred when, from 1930 onwards, the List B course was extended to 2 years, thus Year 1, Essay on Church History, to be written at home. New Testament 3-hour paper. John, based on the Century Bible. Life of Christ, a 3-hour paper, based on Stalker. And Congregational Principles and History, a 3-hour paper, based on the work of Paul and Dale. In Year 2, a sermon submitted from home. Preaching, a 1-hour paper, The Mystery of Preaching by Black. Bible, a 2-hour paper, How to Read the Bible, Aiden. Old Testament, 3-hour paper, 1 and 2 Kings, again based on the Century Bible, and Amos and Hosea, again Century Bible. The first examination, so both parts, were held in 1932. The status for the List B ministers. As the century progressed, those whose names appeared on List B came increasingly to be regarded as ministers rather than evangelists. And indeed, the nature of the work that the majority of them did was indistinguishable from that of fully accredited ministers on this occasion. But they remained unordained, and their stipends and pension entitlements were significantly lower than those of List A ministers. More than that, it seemed to many to be theologically inappropriate for Congregationalists to sanction a 2-tier ministry. Accordingly, when the question was raised by the List be Ministers Association. Committee on Ordination of List B Ministers, mark the word, was appointed as a subcommittee of the Union's General Purpose Committee. It met for the first time on the 5th of December 1950 under the chairmanship of T.T. James. In its typewritten notes, the following assertion is recorded. If a church calls a man and solemnly sets him apart, this is virtually ordination. It was then observed that congregationalists were ill-advised to use the term ordination at all, because it signified election to an order. And this is not how congregationalists think of ministry. However, we have to take our place as congregationalists in relation to other churches. So the term must be kept and understood as signifying A, the ministry confirmed by the local church, and B, the ministry valid in the wider field of Christian service. C, as a standard of capability and competence. As if noticing that God is absent from these three points, it is asserted that while ordination does not confer a special grace, it depends upon God's grace. And lest the point go unheard, there follows the strong declaration that the minister does not do anything that cannot be done by a layman commissioned by the church. Having said that congregationalists have no orders, they proceed to deny it by claiming two, A and B. Ordination is to be reserved for fully qualified persons on list A. In addition, there should be an order of evangelists with certain academic standards and spiritual fitness for whom there should be recognition but not ordination. Services of recognition should be conducted with denominational representatives present. Evangelists should have an induction service at the beginning of their pastorate, but should be recognised at the end of their third year, provided List B was completed and their fitness for the work proved. The committee met again on the 26th of January 1951, and on this occasion Harold Simpson, the Union's Financial Secretary, attended in order to advise his colleagues on the feasibility or otherwise of extending the List A superannuation rights to List B ministers. Further committee meetings followed, and by now the List B question was in the air. On the 10th of January 1952, a letter signed by one of the List B's appeared in the Christian World under the heading Plight of the List B Man. The writer explained that whereas the List A stipend is £300 per annum, his is £250. And when the compulsory national health contributions are paid, he has just £4.10 and tuppence per week for a man and wife to live on. No immediate replies were forthcoming. But in May, the List B question was raised at the council, and towards the end of the year, there was a flurry of correspondence in the press. N.F.B. Dens wrote in favour of the ordination of List B ministers on the ground that Bunyans as well as Owens were needed. This drew a reply from the Reverend B.A.J. Boghurst of Jersey, who declared that the remedy was in the hands of the Lisby ministers themselves. They should study and take Lisby examinations. For the status of an ordained minister is only for those who have won their way. A further correspondent referred to the report of the May Council, which said that the approach of the Lisby Ministers Association had focused attention on the position of the denomination in having two lists, and urged that the anomaly be removed. On the 11th of December, three letters appeared. The first was from Dens, who observed that Boghurst had missed his point, which was that ordination should not be made to depend upon passing examinations. The others were from Norman E. Jones and A.J. Wheeler, A.G. Wheeler, sorry, both of whom sided with the Lisby ministers. A counter came from the Reverend A.H. Richards to the effect that Lisby men are unqualified for the tasks of ministry, though he himself had been one and had proceeded to this day. And Boggers denied that examinations are all, but remained convinced that there must be no easy ways into the ministry. By then, at their meeting on the 20th of October 1952, the Lisby examiners had already made the way slightly harder by resolving that if a candidate failed two papers at one sitting, all papers would have to be retaken, though they excluded the sermon from this rubric. These debates on the status of Lisby ministers rumbled on, and the status committee of the union was reconstituted on the 10th of April 1957. On the 14th of May 1957, during the annual assembly, it was resolved that there shall be one roll of fully trained, accredited and ordained ministers, and that there shall be a scheme of examinations for those who desire to enter the ministry but for whom a college course is not practicable. And regarding this be that A, no further admission to list B after a stated date, B, present list B shall be retained until the demise of those at present named in it or their removal for other reasons, and C, evangelists on list B after the stated date may make application to the status committee through county and provincial committees for inscription upon the roll, the requirements for each case to be determined by the status committee. And it was further resolved that the last occasion on which the first year List B examination shall be held shall be September 1957. Provision was made for those in the midst of their course. The final List B examinations were held in 1962. The solitary candidate sat two papers and was referred to the status committee because of a very poor result in church history and a mark of only 45% in New Testament, even exercising considerable leniency, confessed the examiner. Probably should have been awarded 35%. The last admissions to Listerby occurred in 1962 with one transfer from the Congregational Union of Ireland in 1965. Over the following years, a number of Listerby ministers successfully applied to the Status Committee for admission to the role of ministers, the last of them, Joseph Houston, in 1973. The last yearbook reference to Listerby concerned the deletion of W. Clark and F. J. Smith from the list, together with the notice, "The list will not appear in future yearbooks." Thus, after 16 years of meetings, of admissions to List A, and deletions from List B, List B was no more. List B ministers surveyed. The first obituaries of List B ministers appeared in the Congregational Yearbook for 1931, and the last in the 1966-67 yearbook. We thus have accounts spanning some 35 years, but since the lives they record run from two ministers who were born in 1844, the 177 available obituaries provide a reasonable coverage of the List B years. Some obituaries are helpfully full. A minority lacks such details as date and place of birth and previous occupation. The following information can, however, be supplied. 57 Listerby ministers were born in rural areas, 47 in towns, and 36 in cities. Prior to entering Listerby or becoming Congregationalists, 8 had received post-school education, and 1 was a graduate. 67 served as evangelists, lay pastors, missionaries, and colporteurs. 5 had worked in agriculture. 1 had come from the arts, music. 34 had been in business, clerical, or social work. 10 had worked in industry. 2 had been mines. 1 had been in a profession other than teaching. And 9 had been teachers. Perhaps the most striking thing here is that of the 57 ministers who were born in rural areas, 5 only had worked on the land. Prior to becoming Congregationalist, 1 Listerby minister had worked for the Bible Christian Connection, 3 for the Church of England, 1 for the Episcopal Free Church of England, 1 for the Methodist Church, 1 for the Primitive Methodist Connection, 4 for the Salvation Army, 2 for the Wesleyan Connection, and 1 for the Wesleyan Reform Union. We may also note that 19 Listerby ministers served in World War I, and 1 in World War II. From a county-by-county survey of the number of Listerby ministers born in the county and the number of occasions, 828 in all, on which Listerby ministers undertook pastorates in the county, it emerges that more Listerby ministers were born in London, 14, and Yorkshire, 13, than anywhere else, and the 10 counties received but did not produce any Listerby ministers in the period covered by the obituary. We also see that the southwestern counties were served on 262 occasions by Listerby ministers. The southeastern counties on 134, and the eastern on 131 occasions. while the northwestern counties were served on 62 occasions and the northeastern on 78. Indeed, the single counties of Devon, 67, and Somerset, 68, were served by Lisbon ministers on more occasions than the whole of the Northwest. The obituaries further reveal that five Lisbon ministers chaired county unions: Berkshire, Derbyshire, Devon, Leicestershire, and Norfolk. One chaired a Yorkshire district, and four served as district secretaries: Lancashire, Norfolk, Suffolk, and Wiltshire. Some Lisbon ministers recalled. But much more interesting than the statistics are the ministers themselves, as a few soundings from the obituaries will show. In the first place, we learn that some ministers gave the whole of their ministerial service to one church. This was the case with Arthur Humphreys, whose obituary is the first to be recorded. He was born in 1862 at Norwich, Cheshire, and worked with his father in the building trade while serving as a lay preacher. In 1895, he was appointed to the pastorate of Hayhead in the Bowden group of churches, and there he remained until his death in 1930. He served the village well, establishing a lads' club and an institute. He was on the board of the Guardians and the Rural District Council, in which latter connection he superintended the council's housing scheme for the village. He was a school manager and chaired two charities, and like so many of our village pastors, he became the spiritual guide, trusted friend, and wise counsellor of all. By contrast, John Jeremiah Jordan served no fewer than 11 churches, all of them in Somerset. By further contrast, a few listed being ministers were of the globe-trotting type. Among these was James Rose. He began to work on his father's Sussex farm at the age of 11. He emigrated to Canada at the age of 18 and was ploughing the virgin prairie land. He heard and answered the call to ministry. He undertook training at Glasgow Bible Training Institute and then went to Australia as a home missionary of the Presbyterian Church. From the outbreak of the First World War in 1920, he served in the Australian Army Medical Corps, and then returning to farming in East Sussex. During the next 9 years, he was married and supplied various churches until 1929. He became minister of Amberley and its rural churches in West Sussex. There followed pastorates at Whitehill, Hampshire, and Wingham, and Preston, East Kent, and he retired to Cherry Hinton in Cambridge, where he continued to serve the village churches until he died in 1962, leaving a widow and two sons. There remains one more pattern of service to be considered, that of the minority of Lisbon ministers who, like Alfred Roy Drake, remained in full-time employment. He was employed by an insurance company, and in his spare time he studied at Birkbeck College, London, and served a variety of London churches. Born in 1905, he died in 1940 as a result of an accident, leaving a widow and small daughter. John Pulson of Lavenham likewise remained in employment throughout his working life, but he served just one church, Hartes in Suffolk, from 1891 to 1933. For 13 years, he walked the 5 miles each way from Lavenham until he came by a cycle, and still later was driven there by friends. He was highly regarded in Latham, active with a friendly society, a school manager, a member for 50 years of the parish council, and its chairman for 25 years. He was, we learn, a truly great man, for his was the greatness of those who rejoiced to serve. He and his wife, Mary Ann Tatum, had 7 children, one of whom, Alfred, trained at Peyton College, Nottingham, and held congregational pastorates in Essex and Suffolk, becoming chairman of the latter county union. Born in 1863, John Paulson died in his 87th year on the 14th of February 1950. Examples of Christian work done prior to undertaking congregational ministry abound. Prior to congregational pastorates in Yorkshire, William Thomas Coggan had ministered with great success at the Stanley Park People's Church in Liverpool, from the ranks of which no fewer than 300 men enlisted during World War I. Wilfrid Monk was born into an evangelical congregational home in the Essex village of Goodeaster in 1899. He served in the First World War and, on sensing the call to Christian service, became lay pastor at Mill End Green, Dunmo, at the same time working for the Christian Coal Portage Association. He then had charge of a mission hall in Colchester, and from 1932 until his death in 1952, he served rural pastorates. He was a cheerful and lovable character, we are told, keenly interested in young people, joining in their fun and games. He was the friend and confidant of older people. He was a good man, a devoted minister, a humble but earnest servant of Jesus Christ. Married to Miss Gertrude Lee of High Easter in 1921, their life together was a real partnership in faith and service. There are 3 obituaries of female Elizabethan ministers who remained on that list. When Mabel M. Snowball, 1870 to 1932, a native of Sunderland, died on the 17th of October 1932 at the age of 62 with tragic suddenness, her innumerable friends throughout Teesdale were shocked. For 10 years, from 1912, she had worked with the National British Women's Total Abstinence Union, on whose behalf she had travelled through England and Ireland and had visited South America. On the death of her husband, she became pastor of the church at Cotherstone, where she was then living. And from 1952 until her death, she served amongst the Barnard Castle group of churches. Her uncle, the Reverend Arthur W. Potts, had founded the Christian Endeavour movement in England, and Mabel Snowball opened the first branch in Sunderland and others where she worked. This, I quote, powerful preacher with an attractive style who possessed a gift of human sympathy to a remarkable degree, was buried beside her husband in Coldstone. The Cumbrian, Nellie Watson, was raised in the Church of England, and for 15 years she served as a Church Army sister, notably caring for those in hospitals and homes under the auspices of the Moral Welfare Department. She became uneasy with unspecified doctrines of the Church of England and joined Tyndale Congregational Church, Oxford, where she felt called to the ministry. Called to Barton upon Humber in 1959, her ministry was cut short by her untimely death on the 20th of April 1960. Miss Watson, I quote, was a cultured, brave woman of independent and forthright judgment. Sadly, had no relatives. Ethel Beatrice Boxall, the date of her birth is not quite known, it's either 1899 or 1900, she died in 1966, was the wife of the Reverend K.F. Boxall, who had proceeded via List B to List A. She trained as a school teacher and was especially interested in the Women's Guild movement and the British and Foreign Bible Society. She and her husband served as joint ministers of Petworth from 1946 to 1951 and Burlesford from 1957 to 1959, the only List B partnership of its kind. And it is recorded that her gracious personality attracted young people to her. She had undoubted gifts as a preacher, and she was an organist of considerable talent and served many churches by her music. As we might expect, Lisby ministers, like all other ministers, varied considerably in temperament. Leonard Thomas Foster, who studied at Cliff College and at the Bible Training College, Clapham, is said to have been a man of strong convictions but reserved temperament, was content to bloom in native bower all over the place. In Somerset, which is actually. William George Lambert, who during the First World War had served with the YMCA at Euston Station and in France, lovingly nursed his invalid wife for a number of years. This exhausted him so that following her death, he spent much of his last 6 years in hospital. He was, I quote, a quiet, humble man of a very retiring nature, perhaps with no gifts, but a faithful pastor, one who spent his life serving others. He left no family and no near relatives, but his fellow ministers and many others remember him with deep gratitude and high regard. Arthur Merlin Jones could hardly have been more different. He ministered at Oakham Gates, Wars End on Tyne, and then for 14 years at Selby, where he became widely known. He had a great enthusiasm for amateur dramatics and his use of the tape recorder. He wrote and produced religious plays, and he took tape recordings of church services to the sick and the elderly, and returned from congregational meetings in Leeds with recordings that he played to the members. All his enthusiasms were typified on one occasion in 1957 when he produced a religious play acted by members of various youth organisations in the town. The incidental music for which was played by the local Salvation Band and performed in Selby Abbey. Following training at Cliff College and service as a Wesleyan Connectional Evangelist at Ireland and then briefly at Dumfries, William Young came to Congregationalism and made for London, where he ministered at West Ham Mission, Walthamstow and Bromley by Bow. His final pastorate was at Chelmsford Avenue in Southend. He was enthusiastic, yet gracious, active and full of vigour, yet serene with a rare listening spirit. He brought to his preaching the necessity of decision, to his pastoral work, healing and sympathy, and to his organising thoroughness and vision. And much of his organising concerned buildings. Whilst with the Wesleyans, he built a church in Iron and laid the groundwork for a new school hall at Dumfries. At Southend, renewals and repairs of every kind have been carried out, so that today the buildings show no signs of war's severities. He was also a builder of Christian character, and while many buildings stand as a memorial to him, the greatest memorial is in the lives of those who, under his guidance, decided to accept Christ as their saviour and friend. From two consecutive obituaries, we have evidence that some ministers changed pastorates owing to indifferent health. Frederick William King had 3 months training under the Salvation Army and was then thrown in at the deep end. He suffered persecution and rough handling and carried the scars all his days. 12 years on, ill health prompted his retirement from this strenuous and dangerous work, and he went into business for 2 years. His health improved, and he began to serve congregational churches, sometimes walking 20 miles and preaching 3 times on Sunday. More settled pastorates in the West Country followed until he suffered a further breakdown and was ordered by his doctor to remove to the Lake District for his bracing air. Hence, his pastorates at Cleethorne, Moor and Bootle, probably the most isolated congregational cause in England. Following his retirement, he continued at Bootle, unpaid, for a further 14 years until a successor was found. Walter Seymour Seeger, another who had studied at Cliff College, had been a Wesleyan lay pastor for 12 years. Following a pastorate at Cannington and neighbouring villages, he was called to Haresfinch, St Helens, in 1947. But within a year, it became clear that his health was not equal to the demands of a northern climate. So whereas King had gone north for his health, Seeger returned south for his. He accepted a call to show Alice in Dorset in 1948, and in the following year he died. A number of the ministers majored, like maybe Snowball, on the temperance aspect of the non-conformist conscience. George, James, Charette among them. Born at Bishop Sutton near Winchester on the 9th of May 1848, sadly he soon was an orphan, but was lovingly raised by his grandfather, and after some years in business, he had a succession of pastorates in Hampshire. He worked for the Rechabite Order, the Hants and Isle of Wight Band of Hope Union, and the Good Templars. But he also served the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, Scouts, and other charitable bodies. He was a true and stalwart nonconformist, and bore much persecution because of loyalty to principle, and stood firm as the one non-conformist representative on the old established church school board. Among the many other tidbits yielded up by the obituaries, we find that George Roberts founded a special mission at Pole Elm, Worcestershire, for seasonal hop pickers. When George MacDonald, who had begun his ministry at Kell and Thwaite, and then served 5 years at Kirby Lonsdale doing brain work in a lonely place, died after just 4 months at Dundee. His wife, always a true helpmeet, survived him and is the chosen pastor at Dundee. William Rowland Davidson had worked for the Protestant Truth Society for 16 years. Harold Holland died whilst conducting a service on the 8th of October 1950. John Baines went from first violinist at the Theatre Royal Peterborough to three pastorates, of which the longest kept him cycling around four churches in the hilly land around Fording Bridge for 40 years until he was well over 75 years of age. George Albert Hibbert seems to have had what the epistle calls itching ears, in that he resigned his Dudley pastorate in order to become the West Midlands Area Commissioner of the British Israel World Federation. Putting first things first, Albert Morrison's obituaries informs us that he was a good athlete for Jesus Christ, beloved on the rugby field and bowling green, as well as in the church. Norman Reed, a Northumbrian schoolteacher turned pastor at Jarrow and then at Preesall, was noted for his pastoral care and the way he used his gift of muscular manipulation for the healing of many patients. Among honours bestowed upon this B men was the presidency of the Countess of Huntington's Connection, held by Edwin Tully in 1938. William Frederick Eames' investiture by King George VI as a Knight of the Order of St. John of Jerusalem, and the OBE, which was awarded to George Nicholls, J.P. But George Nicholls, who'd been Member of Parliament for North Northamptonshire and four times Mayor of Peterborough, is unique in another way too. For lapsing into Disney-esque language, his obituaries assures us that on the 30th of November 1943, he passed into Yonderland. As he is a personal reflection, as the years pass, the number of those who have personal memories of List B ministers becomes even fewer. For this reason, I conclude this study by paying tribute to the one I know best. Although Henry Alfred Grant Osborne was justifiably transferred by the Status Committee of the Congregational Union to the single role of ministers in 1958, for most of the years in which he and I were quite regular contact, he was on this theme. He was born on the 22nd of October 1895 in Portsmouth and never lost his rich Hampshire birth. He became a member of the Church of Redhill, and from there he embarked upon lay preaching. Wounded in the First World War, he spent a year in hospital, and then, according to his obituary, he read theology at Manchester University. albeit the university has no record of a theological student of that name during the years 1980 to 1923. And he would surely have mentioned this to me when he knew that my steps were tending in that direction. In 1923, he and Nellie Walker were married, and in due course, Joan was born. In 1926, they removed to Portsmouth, and in 1929, Grant became the founding lay pastor of the Congregational Church at Corsham, proceeding to Bishops Waltham, Botley, and East End, Lymington in 1932. Whilst there, he studied for the List B examinations. In 1933, he was examined in Bible, 58%, Essay, 90%, Congregational History and Principles, 60%. In the following year, he submitted the sermon, 62%. And in 1935, he satisfied the examiners in Bible, 56%. Old Testament Part 1, 72%. Old Testament Part 2, 43%. And preaching, 55%. Thereby completing the course and gaining access to this field. In 1940, Grant accepted a call to Wasatch, and there he remained until 1948. He served as chaplain to HMS Tormento and was a member of an air raid precautions continued, while his wife was appointed by the Archbishop of Canterbury to work among the Wrens, the Women's Royal Naval Service. In 1948, he entered upon his final and probably his most significant pastorate. He became one of the two village ministers in the Guildford group of churches. He, his wife, and Joan lived at Wash. And it was not long before Grant and the vicar, Hugh G.B. Anthony, struck up good ecumenical relations. Nor need we guess who became the first nonconformist to preach at the nearby St. John's Roman Catholic Seminary. In the midst of her busy rounds as a district nurse, Joan founded the Tangley Players, the name taken from the barn in which the church first met during the 1860s. Religious plays were performed on Christian festivals and significant church occasions, always to a packed church, and much blessing has attended this experiment. In 1960, the church celebrated its centenary, and a number of special services were held. The first of these was conducted by the moderator of the Sabbath Conference, W. Andrew James, and during its 17 new members were received. Previous ministers conducted the remaining services in series. The climax of the year was the Tangley Players' production of A Pageant of Congregationalism. Meanwhile, in 1958, the entire group of churches, and indeed the wider denomination, had been shocked by the sudden death of James Alfred Kay, the Congregational Bishop of Guildford. He was a remarkable man who possessed the skill of combining ebullience with dignity. He threw himself into good works all around the district, and indeed this ardent supporter collapsed and died whilst at a Guildford City football club match. The large city church looked to one of its district ministers for support and guidance, and Grant Osborne did not disappoint them. On the contrary, he gave, I quote, magnificent service, not only in the churches under his immediate care, but during the very difficult interim months after the death of Dr. K. He courageously shouldered the additional responsibility of the North Street Church during the 17 months when the church sought a new pastor. And in this, he had the support of a magnificent band of deacons. During this hectic period, Grant Osling lost the tangible support of his wife, who died in 1959. In 1971, Grant retired, but continued his chaplaincy at Guildford Crematorium. He went to art classes and became a skilled watercolourist. In 1973, he and Joan were moved to Norfolk, where Joan became senior nursing officer in the Cromer area. Two further moves followed, and they ended up at Houghton on the Norfolk Broads and became members of Jessop Road Congregational Church in Norwich, whose members appointed Grant an honorary associate minister. He continued to serve in the churches of the area and gave 18 months to the North Walsham Church. In 1986, he suffered a stroke which affected the whole of his left side, but 3 weeks later, he was walking normally, and he maintained his preaching duties until 1989, when he fell and broke his shoulder. Cared for to the end by Joan, he died peacefully on the 31st of August, 1992, aged 96. Although my church membership was in a non-Guildford church, I came to know Grant well, though in those days he was Mr. Osborne. He was among those who ensured that I was kept busy with preaching appointments before and during my college years. I was thus able to visit the Guildford district churches at Cartbridge, Merrow, Normandy and Shanley Green, Stoughton Road, Guildford, Westborough and Wash. Since my pastorate was to be at Sedbergh, when then in the Yorkshire Dales, my home church at Worplesdon arranged a valedictory service for me, the distance being too great and the journey too daunting in those pre-motorway days for more than a handful to make the trip to the ordination service. Among those taking part was Grant Osborne, who read the lessons. Grant conducted worship with dignity and utter sincerity. His conceived prayers were thoughtful and orderly. The following was among his favourite printed prayers. O Jesus, Master Carpenter of Nazareth, who died on the cross with wood and nails, has wrought man's full salvation. Wield well thy tools in this thy workshop, that we who come to thee rough-hewn may be fashioned to a truer beauty by thy hand. For thy name and glory's sake. Amen. His preaching was of a kind to command the hearer's attention, and what he said was always worth hearing. His pastoral care was exemplary, and his genuine affection for young and old alike was unbounded. I dedicate this paper to his memory in memoriam. Henry Alfred Grant Osborne. 1895 to 1992.